So hi, everybody. Good morning. Good morning. It's good to see all of you here today. So today, I would like to first start by taking you on a trip in the way, way back machine. And the year is 1992. And for those of you who might be a little too young to remember that year very clearly, I'll ask you to, as we think about the HIV and AIDS epidemic that was taking place at that time, you can picture in your mind if you've seen Dallas Buyers Club. That's a good image. So as you see the faces that appear on the screen, those of us that were aware of this epidemic in the 80s and 90s, we're continuously reminded, and we would see these people that were our stars that were struck down by this disease, Freddie Mercury and Arthur Ashe and Ryan White and Magic Johnson and others, that the way it would happen is we would see a headline that would say something to the effect of, Rock Hudson has announced that he has HIV, and 2 months later, he'd be gone. Or in the case of Freddie Mercury, as you can see in this passage from the news clipping, he had announced the day before that he had HIV and died the following day. Now, that wasn't because the disease went that quickly. It was spreading much more rapidly then than it does now with the help of all sorts of great medicines. But with this disease came disgrace, questions about people's sexuality, questions about promiscuity. This was not a disease that you wanted to get because it came with this questionable character as well. So 1992 was the backdrop for me for a phone call I received from my first husband at work. He was in the hospital with pneumonia, and I knew he was in the hospital with pneumonia. He was getting good treatment, and he was crying. And this was a person that really didn't cry. And I said, you know, what's going on? And he said, they've tested me for AIDS, and they say I have it. And you can probably imagine what might go through your head. I can tell you what went through my head. I left my little office cube, and I went and sat in the bathroom. I went and sat on the floor, and I thought to myself, man, you know, I'm 24 years old. I'm not going to make it to 30. This, you know, why me? This was a super, super scary, scary time. Well, the good news is that my life could have ended there, but that was 22 years ago. And since my diagnosis, I've really gotten to live a full, full life. And we don't have enough time today for me to tell you about the last 22 years in detail. You might be wishing you had HIV by the time it's over. But all I can say is that I've been so, so blessed in my life. And I often tell people, I would never wish this disease upon anyone, but I can't imagine my life without it. And so today when I look at these pictures, and I was trying to pick pictures to put in this presentation today, I just think about how blessed I've been. I have this wonderful husband, wonderful family, and my wonderful son, Carter. It's just so, so great. So you might be asking yourself, well, you know, how did this happen? How did you get here? How does this relate to the Bible? Or, you know, what am I going to get at Target today? You know, I can't help you with the last question. But I do want to spend a little bit of time today on one topic. One thing that I've been reflecting on a lot recently as I've had the opportunity to look back and look at 22 years. I want to talk about living outrageously. I want to talk about people that have made a difference in my life because of the outrageous actions that they took. Now, certainly medicine and a supportive family and friends have made a huge, huge difference, but there are lots and lots and lots of people that have had HIV and aren't here today and had those things too and aren't here today to tell their story. So I'd like to share with you really how I got so lucky because of people that were living outrageously. And when I say living outrageously, I don't mean, you know, wearing a funky dress to church or, you know, just being, you know, bold and crazy. Maybe that's part of it as well. But when I think of outrageous living, I think about it's when we go and above and beyond to help people that need it most. And it often it's going against societal norms. Sometimes it's at great personal risk, or it's just outside of our comfort zone, just not what we want to do. But I'm here today to tell you that in doing so, we can affect the course of people's lives. We may never know it, but I just, I trust me, I truly believe it. And the Bible tells us that story as well when we look at the story of Moses. Now, when you think of Moses, or when I think of Moses, the first image that comes to mind, for those of you who've seen the Ten Commandments with Charlton Heston, is Charlton Heston. And it's, and I'll also get to Yul Brynner, so no one should feel left out if they like this, so it is written, so shall it be done, moment. But when you think about Moses' life, we often hear about the burning bush and we think about parting of the Red Seas, but we often forget that Moses lived as Pharaoh's grandchild. His life was a privileged life. He was not living as a Hebrew slave. He was living a privileged life. But what Moses chose to do and what led to the rest of the actions that he took was he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew. He saw it in his life. And he didn't look away, but he looked around to see if anybody was watching, and he killed the Egyptian. And he hid him, and he took great, great personal risk. And we could see in the quote here that when Pharaoh heard of it, he sought to kill Moses. Moses made a choice that changed his life forever. And it was only after that that we see the actions that God took towards Moses. And we see Moses' strength in standing up to Pharaoh as much as he didn't want to. And ultimately, we see Moses, who, as Elie Wiesel, if any of you have read the book Night, he's a Auschwitz survivor, a powerful, powerful writer. He talks about Moses I'll use his words, the immensity of his task and the scope of his experience command our admiration, our reverence, and our awe. That Moses, you know, after him, nothing was the same again. And, you know, remember, Moses never made it to the Promised Land. You know, Moses made it right there, but didn't get in. Yet he changed the world. So I'd like you to have that. That's when I think of outrageous living and outrageous lifers, that's the kind of actions that I think of. So I've got some real life experiences that I'd like to share with you for a few minutes. Of course, I couldn't pick everyone. And it's so nice, by the way, to look out and see so many of you who have had that kind of effect on me as well. So thank you. Thank you for being here as well. But let me take you back. Now, this is not really a picture of my friend Tom Benyon, but it was the closest I could come to and to hopefully give you an image of this person that was my boss. So here I am, diagnosed and 24 years old, and I need to tell my boss. And he was the president of the company I worked for at the time. He'd been my mentor. He was a banker. He was a banker's banker. You know, real creamed hair, suit, perfect. And so I go into his office to tell him what's up. And he looks at me and he goes, you know, I think we should tell everybody. And I said, are you kidding me? You know, have you seen the headlines? Do you know how people are treated when they say they have HIV or have AIDS? And he's like, no. He goes, people are going to find out. So when people find out and you've hid that from them, it's going to seem shameful. So I really think we should tell everybody. So I thought about it, and I said, okay. So I get back to the office. He said, go take a week off. I'm going to tell everybody. I get back in the office, and I'm sitting in my little cube. And people come by my office, and they're so supportive. They're like, just what can we do for you? How can we help you? I mean, one after another after another. It was incredible. And somebody said, hey, do you want to know what Tom said to us when he told us? He said, he brought us into the conference room, about 8 or 10 of us at the time. And he said, Betsy's got HIV. If you treat her any differently, you're fired. So, you know, I just love that story. I could tell that story 1,000 times, and I probably have told that story 1,000 times. But, you know, here was something that he didn't have to do that. I mean, in that time frame, if you remember that time frame, I mean, you know, I had the 1992 equivalency of leprosy. I mean, and here's this man, he made work a safe place for me. And I stayed there for 22 years. And through merger after merger, but his support of me, you know, got me to where I was going to be. The next group of people I want to tell you just briefly about was so I was living in Florida at the time, in the heart of the Bible Belt, but I was lucky enough to belong to a United Church of Christ church that was just a great place. And again, not exactly who you want to be telling that you have HIV at that era. Remember Ryan White? I mean, he couldn't even go to school. So I remember I was about a week or so into my diagnosis. I said, well, I've got to tell the folks that I sing with in the choir. I mean, I see them all the time. I can't keep it a secret. And no sooner were those words out of my mouth than these women are hugging me and, you know, fawning all over me. And these are like, you know, solid, you know, southern white women of, you know, about 70 years old. I mean, AIDS and HIV, you know, they didn't know anything about that, but they just loved me unconditionally, and it made church for me a place where I knew I belonged, and it gave me that spiritual hope. I realized that God was on my side. God wasn't up there flinging down this stuff on me. God was helping to pump me up. So I'll flash forward a little bit to someone you might know. This is he didn't get to see these pictures. I didn't show him. This is my husband, Joe. This was a little before I met him, and I think it was before braces too, but I know. But this is a cheap shot, but I needed to make sure, everybody was still with me here. So everybody was paying attention. They put down their Target grocery list. Okay. Yeah, that's your baby boy. There he is. Let those saddle shoes, he still has those saddle shoes, by the way. But okay, so enough of that. So as you can imagine, dating when you have HIV, after I'd gotten a divorce, after a number of years of caring for my first husband, I'd gotten a divorce and I was living on my own. And as you can imagine, dating with HIV it's not exactly what you put on your Match.com profile. You know, blonde hair, blue eyes, HIV. You know, it's not. It just does. You know, doesn't quite attract the kind of people you want to attract. But so I meet this great guy, Joe, and my rule was, on the second date, I got to tell the person. First date, it's not first date material. Second date, you sort of know if it's going to go somewhere. So we're on the second date. And I am waiting to the last minute of the last minute of the last minute. We have this nice dinner. Joe probably remembers everything about that dinner. I don't remember a thing about that dinner. Because I knew that at the end of this dinner, I had to tell him. And the whole thing could just go, you know, kerplutz. So I've waited to the last minute, to the last minute, to the last minute. And I finally said, you know, Joe, there's something I got to tell you. And I don't react now, but just, you know, just hear what I have to say. And, you know, just then you can think on it and tell me what you think. So I said, I've got HIV. So, you know, Joe, if you know Joe's a deep thinker, thinks about things a lot. He's like, okay, think about that. So we went our separate ways that evening. And the next day, because Joe and I happened to work at the same company, I was heading out of town, and Joe said, hey, come in my office. I want to talk to you for a second. And he just said, yeah, you know what you told me last night? I'm okay with it. And then he goes on to say, which is my favorite punchline, he goes, I actually thought you were going to tell me something much worse. And I was like, much worse. He goes, yeah, I thought you were going to say your dad is in the Klan. So, sorry, honey. I can't resist. I love that story because there's a whole different sermon about about how we, all the baggage we all carry around. So, but that's not what I'm here to say. So, like I said, Joe didn't have to do any of those things. And here I am, I'm married to this great guy. I've got this great kid. I mean, how much better could it get? Well, lest you think this is all a talk about how you treat people that have an illness, I want to tell you about one more outrageous person, a person who lives outrageously and also doesn't know that I'm going to talk about them. But Nancy Samuel, who is, happens to be here today, who, if you know her, and it's hard not to know her, because she is the friendliest, kindest mother-in-law that that you could have. So Joe and I were married, and we were going to Joe's cousin's 50th birthday celebration. It was a weekend-long celebration, and if you knew Joe's cousin, you'd understand it needed to be a weekend-long celebration. Sort of bigger-than-life kind of gal. And we were running a little bit late for one event, and she was having a tea that afternoon, and all the ladies wore their hats. And we'd running a little bit late because we'd been out to lunch with Joe's parents. And I get there by myself, Joe dropped me off, and I walk in the door, I'm standing in the door, and I'm looking around, like a crowd, maybe not this big, of black women that are looking at me. And yeah, as I look at this sort of sea of white people, you may not have ever had the experience of being in the minority. And I mean, I could tell you from personal experience the number of times Joe has told me and his parents that have been in the minority. Well, here I was in the minority. And I was standing there in that door, and I felt like people were just shooting daggers at me. I just felt like, oh my gosh, you know, they're saying I don't belong. You know, wrong party, next door, you went to the wrong place. And no sooner had I had a chance to process that thought that Nancy was up out of her seat, and she comes running up to me at the door, and she says, "It's my daughter, it's my daughter. Can I, let me introduce you to my daughter." And she took me around to every single table, and she introduced me. And I can't tell you how many times I've thought of that story. And I've thought about it whenever I'm in a situation where I'm in the majority and I see somebody that's in the minority, whatever that minority might be. Because if you've never had that experience, it's awful. I mean, you just feel like, you know, I felt like I had three arms and, you know, four heads. I just wanted to shrink into a little ball. But Nancy made it like I had a room of friends. So I just wanted to say thank you. Thank you. So these are some super outrageous people. And, you know, so you might be thinking, okay, who, you know, me? Those are some pretty, you know, special circumstances. I can't, that's not me. That's not me. I got too many things to do, you know. And you know, when we read the Bible, we see, there's a great passage that I love, and it's this one that we've all heard, and we've heard it in different ways and shapes and forms, which is basically the judge not, lest you be judged. But when you ask yourself that question, you know, should I live outrageously? Should I live this way? Should our goal really be just judge not? You know, if Nancy or Joe or Tom, or my friends at church, had just taken the judge not approach, they just would have sat there in their seats and been good and maybe smiled at me. You know, maybe we never would have gotten married. That's not judging. But in my mind, that's just the bar. That's like the getting in the game. That's the table stakes. That's the opening ante. I really think that God is asking more of us. You know, my other favorite passage is this one, that, you know, to everyone to whom much has been given, much will be required. And from the one to whom much has been entrusted, even more will be demanded. You know, we hear that, you know, during the stewardship month, you know, we think about it during money, and, you know, it's easy to say, that's not me, I don't have any money, and, you know, not me. But we're all here today. You know, if you're, as far as I'm concerned, if you're vertical, and if you're in this room, you've been entrusted with a lot. You have been given blessings after blessings. And so that's what I want you to think about, is how blessed we all are just to be here on this planet. I mean, think about it. I think about it all the time. I thought about it since I was 24 years old. And so that's really what I wanted to share with you today, was this gift that I've been given from these people that did these things, they just didn't have to do them. And when I look back, I consistently come to these same images that have helped me each step of the way. So I give this to you as my gift, these images, and I hope that you take them with you today. And I want to leave you with one final thought to take us back to Moses for a second. Is this quote from Rabbi Harold Kushner, who you may know from the book When Bad Things Happen to Good People. Talk about a book that I could read over and over and over again. This is from his more recent book that I just listened to. So I've been telling Dale, I swear I've been like quoting every part of this book to Dale recently. He doesn't even have to read it at this point. But bear with me as I read you this one last thought and some of the passages I've highlighted here. If you have been brave enough to love, and sometimes you won and sometimes you lost, you've cared enough to try, and sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't, and you've been bold enough to dream and found yourself with some dreams that came true and a lot of dreams that ended up like broken pieces, then you can look back from the mountaintop you now find yourself on, and you, like Moses, can realize how full your life has been and how richly you have been blessed. So with that, I say, amen.